sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Fourth quarter GDP revised upward to 1.4%. U.S. equity markets finished down for the first week in about four. And China industrial profits show a gain, finally. All this and much more on episode number 456 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, happy Easter to everybody. It is the end of March 2016. I'm Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We had a guest lined up for this week, but I don't know. Somehow our wires got crossed and called him, just talked to him and kind of set up the whole thing. And the studio was ready and everything was ready to go. And no one was there. So, Mark Grant, wherever you are, want to have you on the show, but we'll see what happens from here. Anyway, it is the end of March. We have some interesting economic reports to share with you, some coming up next week. Of course, last week was a holiday shortened week with Good Friday on Friday. So markets were closed, but we did see that GDP was revised higher for the fourth quarter, up to 1.4%. We're going to get to that in a second. I think it's pretty amazing, that revision. If you think about the differential, it's pretty astounding. 0.4% higher than anticipated and revised. That's, you know, it may seem like a small amount, but we'll get to that in a second. Let me kind of give you a rundown of some of the things that went on last week. We saw that new homes in the month of February increased 2%, and all of the gains, all, were attributed to a 38.5% jump in sales in the West, which had a tremendous plunge in January in the new home purchases department. So I wonder what was going on there. If maybe this kind of just was maybe the numbers for January somehow didn't get in. You know how that goes sometimes. You see that they come out with the numbers, but they're not quite sure. And the next month comes in and revised. So I don't really think that massive jump that we just saw in the month was really necessarily something that was anything more than just a revision. So either way, how you want to slice it, we did see that the increase in new home sales for February of 2% was better, of course, and that's good. But again, I think it's just a catch-up from the previous month. So we'll have to kind of watch this as we go. Now, what's also interesting to note is that the NAR, National Association of Realtors, noted that in February there was a 7% decline in existing home sales, with, as they said, tightening inventory a major factor. Okay, well, kind of a tale of different situations. But again, I think that if you put the month of January and February together for both of those, you'll see that the trend has softened somewhat, but yet still not something to be very excited about either direction. Now, last month, the median sales price of new homes was $301,000, which is up about 2.5% for the year. And the existing home price was about $210,000, up 4.5% from about 12 months ago. So that was good. We're still seeing an expansion in pricing for homes. So that's generally a good thing, right? We're seeing that as a inflationary factor, meaning people want to buy homes, meaning people are anxious to go out and buy at a higher price than they have. So we're seeing the trend that continues to see that higher prices of homes is something that is beneficial. That's a good thing. When the problem that the Fed has with all of this, in that they didn't raise rates for a long time, is they created a lot of complacency. They created a lot of just sit on your laurels and wait till one day prices maybe stabilize or come down. There was no urgency to worry about the fact that interest rates were going to skyrocket anytime soon, because they kept on talking them down. They kept on saying that, you know what, we're going to have interest rates at a very low rate at a very extended period of time. That does not give anyone the desire to say, oh my, I really have to do something now. I really have to go out there and just go and buy a house because I'm so worried about the future that, man, interest rates are going to rise and I want to get ahead of this. But what happened was that they did raise rates in December. And I think that that's very smart. And they need to continue talking that talk about raising rates, because if they do, regardless of the market, the initial market response and what's going to happen in the short term with markets, forget that for a second. If, in fact, they talk about how rates should be going higher and they act on it, people are going to start getting off that fence. They're going to start to say, you know, sooner or later, rates are going to go higher. And it may be sooner than later. And that being the case, maybe I want to get that loan and lock in. Maybe I want to refinance. I want to make sure that I can get that rate right now. Maybe I want to go buy that house. Maybe I want to go get that business that I was looking for, that business loan, whatever it may be. They're going to possibly go out and do a lot more than they were, because even though money was very cheap, it will continue to be cheap, but it will give them the incentive to go do something. So I think that's an important part of what the Fed should be doing right now, is actually hinting that rates will be going higher. And again, not worry so much about the market reaction. The market will take care of itself. Of course, they don't want to stifle the market. They don't want to suffocate earnings. They don't want to suffocate the ability for companies to expand and to prosper. But at the same time, we're talking about very small incremental moves that can have a very substantial effect on the mentality and psyche of individuals in their efforts to go and do something, incentivize them to actually go and do something that they wouldn't do before. Now, in terms of the economy, we did see that it did expand at 1.4%. That was released on Friday, even though the markets were closed on Friday for the Good Friday holiday closure. And this is kind of interesting, because in the fourth quarter, it was originally somewhere about 1%, spot on 1%, that the last two numbers came out. This is the third and final revision that just came out at 1.4%. So if you think about the size of our economy, and you think about almost 0.5% gain as compared to what they had originally had put in as their estimate, that is an enormous gain. Now, on one hand, let's just say that that's great. So the U.S. economy is not looking like, at this point, from a GDP standpoint, that there's any recession imminent, because we are seeing that there is, while slow growth, there is growth. So maybe the idea of recession in the U.S., especially in the fourth quarter, where things really started to slow down towards the end of the fourth quarter and into January of this year, things were still chugging along. But how do they make such an incredibly large mistake? Or how are they unable to accurately measure the economy? And we're not talking about a revision from, let's say, 1% to 0.9 or to 1.1. We're talking about 0.5% change. 40% or so differential in the growth rate of the economy from the first reading to the third reading. And really, this is the second reading to the third reading. That's what this change was, right? It went from 1% to 1.4 from the second reading to the third reading. That's a big number. Now, if we don't have a handle and ability to really accurately measure our GDP here in the U.S., and the government has to do several different revisions to that number in order to provide us with an quote-unquote accurate number of what the GDP was for the quarter, takes them three separate stabs at it, if you will, to give us a good number that we can rely on how the economy, the underlying economy, and the total economy, the totality of all the business that went on in the United States did for just that period of time. How do some countries like China have the ability to do it at all? Kind of boggles the mind a little bit. I think the most frustrating thing is that these revisions are so wide and have been so for a good period of time. Even with the change in how they calculate GDP that was implemented last year, if you remember that, they kind of changed the first quarter because first quarters were always soft and then second quarters were a bit stronger. So what happened was they revised the way in which they would provide the information and calculate it. So the first quarter would be much more on par with other quarters, and seasonal adjustments would go in there. And the second quarter may be a little bit weaker, but it would still average out to be a much better read on a seasonally adjusted basis and utilizing this new calculation methodology. So now they still can't do it. Whatever. It's kind of a very frustrating thing to really try to follow the economics, because we know that statistically there are aberrations that occur. Seasonality or even labor participation rate concepts are embedded in the calculation. It makes it very difficult to really judge what is happening with the underlying economy. And the more and more we get the various reporting entities providing us with any kind of numbers that are revised or, better yet, statistically altered, creates that much more of a question mark in terms of really what's happening with the economy itself. And then we have the big issue of things like, kind of taking this to the next extreme, not seasonal adjustments, but things like currency adjustments, which has been in play for companies for the last year or so, talking about constant currency-based estimates and constant currency-based reports of earnings and revenues. Now, we also saw that the durable goods numbers came out last week. Overall orders for capital goods dropped about almost 3% for February. Now, when you remove transportations, numbers were better. Now, the big problem was that durable goods orders were just about 1% in the period. Now, in January, the overall durable goods orders increased 4.2%, while the core was only at 1.2%. So, you know, again, depending on what you put in, what you take out, transportation was a major, obviously a major a drag on it for the period. But that didn't really see much of an effect. Usually, durable goods orders, manufacturing numbers, and GDP are major reports that affect markets and markets look at very closely. Now, GDP, again, wasn't, you couldn't see what happened to the markets because it was closed here. But other than that, the durable goods orders really had no effect on markets. I didn't see anything major happen when it came to new home sales. There was just a very muted reaction. Maybe that was because that many traders were taking an early week. That's why volumes were so low last week. Probably I think last week, two of the days were two of the lowest volume days on the indices this year to date. And last week, was a down week. And it's being blamed on these comments from the Fed. There was a variety of Fed speakers that came out last week and talked up the whole idea of, well, you know what? We are probably going to start increasing rates at a faster rate this year, which, again, makes you scratch your head. You're like, wait a minute. Didn't Janet Yellen just say there's only going to be two rate increases? Then they said, well, and also we think that the market should stop looking at the dot plot. We're supposed to be watching this. This is the thing for all benefits that will accrue to, for transparency and the opportunity for markets to really understand much better and not be surprised by anything that happens with the Fed. This dot plot was something that we were supposed to be watching. And on top of that, we were supposed to be able to understand what was happening, because the numbers and on reports of economic activity were going to be what the Fed was going to be really focusing on. And on top of that, we know that their target rate for unemployment and their target rate for inflation was what it was. And then Janet Yellen pretty much blew that all up to hell. Just said last week or the week before when she talked, well, you know what? Yeah, we're at our target rate for unemployment. And yeah, we're kind of at the inflation rate. But you know what? To hell with it. And then they come out this week and talk about how we should pretty much be throwing out the dot plot. So what that means to me is that they use any tool that they can in their communication policy to try to twist, manipulate, and to steer, that's a good word, steer the markets the way they want them to move, so that they can keep markets higher, keep that carrot in front. Because don't forget, if we were going to use the dot plot, if we were going to use economic numbers, well, the fact is they should be raising rates by all standards. But they don't want to do that. And as such, they say, well, we're just not going to really stick to that plan anymore. So there were these very much more interest rate hike oriented discussions from a couple of different Fed Reserve speakers, Bullard being one of them. And there was a drop in the markets, nothing major, but the S&P was down about 0.7%. The NASDAQ was down about 0.5%. The Dow Jones was also down about 0.5%. Now, gold was one of the worst hit for the week. It had its worst week in more than 5 months, dropping about 2.5% for the week. Now, oil finished the week just slightly below the 40 mark. That's kind of a number that I think we're going to see as a potential, we'll call it a fighting point, a battle zone, a line in the sand. There's going to be a lot of play around that $40 line for oil coming up. Now, this week coming up on Monday, we're going to have consumer spending and pending home sales reports. Janet Yellen is going to be speaking on monetary policy on Tuesday. And we're also going to see the Conference Board's new consumer confidence survey, along with the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index and earnings from companies like Lennar, which will give us a really good read. We saw KB Homes come out last week with a really good number, and the stock did very well. Lennar is coming out this week, so we're going to see a lot more about the housing sector and the earnings there and their outlook. Now, Wednesday, we're going to have March ADP employment numbers. The change in the private payrolls is going to be coming from them. We have Lululemon coming out and Paychex. On Thursday, the Challenger job cut report, new initial claims figures. And on Friday, we're going to have the latest unemployment report, or the employment report, depending on how you want to look at it. We're going to see the final March consumer sentiment report from the University of Michigan and ISM manufacturing and PMI. And China's latest PMI will all be coming out on Friday. So all the manufacturing numbers out of China will be coming on Friday for us to check out there. So with that, the S&P is now down ever so slightly for the year. Dow Jones slightly up for the year. NASDAQ is down about 4.5% for the year. So I think that when we look at next week, now that people are rested, back from holiday, nothing else in the way, probably going to see a lot of gyrations in the markets in anticipation of Yellen speaking, although it's not an official report per se in terms of the, well, I guess it is. I mean, you know, I guess we have to listen to every one of her discussions as clues to what's happening here. But it does seem that from what the other Fed policy makers have discussed in last week's conversation was that each and every week we should be aware of, okay, what's happening with economics. However, even though we talked about only two rate hikes here, each meeting that we have each and every month is possibly going to be live, meaning we have the opportunity to take a look at the potential for a rate hike every month throughout, maybe not only the end of this year, but sometime into the future. So kind of stay on your toes, folks. That's what's going to be the play right now. And there's a lot of very interesting technical marks and levels on the S&P 500, that 2050 level that we've been discussing as a top line. We did see that earnings are going to start coming out next week or the week after. The blackout period for discretionary share buybacks is going to be on the table, which means that we won't have much of the companies buying back their shares, which have been a major component of the recent rally once they were able to buy their shares back, because we have seen the continuation of retail investors pulling money out of equity positions and equity funds, equity ETFs in the U.S. over the last number of weeks. It started to level off a little bit towards the end here as we did see the market rally back in and people were a bit more comfortable putting money in. But yet, without that underpinning of many of the companies doing their share buybacks and their programs that they have billions of dollars available to do, the big question is going to be, who is going to be supporting the markets at this point? Now, one of the more interesting things that we saw was that with the latest GDP report, there was a new breakout, a separation and introduction of information regarding corporate profits. And in the U.S., the corporate profits in 2015 dropped about 5%. Well, we kind of knew that. We've been seeing that profitability has been falling as compared to a year ago where it was about 1% drop. So essentially, you could think that we are in an earnings recession, even though GDP is the official quote-unquote recession gauge, where we see two consecutive quarters of negative growth equals a recession. But yet, at the same time, we're seeing that manufacturing is pretty slow. We know that. We see that the non-manufacturing, the service sector is kind of slowing down a bit. We know that. We see that inventory levels are starting to build a little bit. But with this breakout of the information regarding corporate profits, we're clearly seeing that there is a slowdown, a drop. We're not seeing the growth. Now, this is something that I've been talking about for a while. The whole idea that how do we get valuations to a level that we are seeing not only now, but into the future, with the fact that if corporate profits are slowing, earnings are slowing, revenues are slowing, the only thing that's really supporting us right now is the fact that we have a tremendously low interest rate environment. And that should, by its very nature, of course, bring valuations a bit higher. So in other words, when you take the multiple of the earnings, it should be higher. That's just a natural process because really there's no other place to put money. You can't put money in things like the bank and savings accounts, CDs, things like that. You haven't even probably heard of CDs in a long time or even thought of them, where we used to think of cash as an alternative that would be a place of, we'll call it a safety parking place for some time. Now, there is obviously reasons for keeping money in cash in your portfolio for a lot of different reasons. But one of the things that we're seeing now is that when you look at the outward projection for earnings and you look at the current PE ratio, which we're right back towards the top of the range, 17.5 approximately on the S&P 500, as we were when we saw that there was the height in 2015 of the markets, because profits have slowed down, earnings have slowed down even more, so the multiple is not pulling it up as much to the levels as much. But still, we're seeing that the PE ratio and the multiplier, if you will, is towards the top of the range when it comes to the S&P 500. You have to stop in for a second and wonder what else is going to fuel this rally. Will it be additional quantitative easing, stimulus of some sorts, possibly? I'm just speculating here. Maybe there's some euphoria over the next presidential candidate who's going to come into office and make some serious changes, whether it be, I guess at this point, who do you have? Possibly Cruz, possibly Trump, Sanders, Clinton. I don't know. Take your pick of one of those that will actually be a catalyst in the form of profitability and growth, not only for companies, but the U.S. economy. Of course, we do know that each and every candidate, one of their most important platforms is the economy, because that's what will hit you and I most personally and will get us to be incentivized, kind of a theme of this discussion today about the incentivizing us to do something, but that will incentivize us to possibly vote for them. Because listen, if they start talking about something that's totally unrelated to us, but something that we all agree with, maybe something, you know, really good, like talking about term limits, oh, that's a great idea on maybe for the Senate or for Congress, but that doesn't really affect us personally, does it? If they talk about maybe some global trade, that kind of has some effect on us, I guess we could say, but it doesn't really touch me in my pocket right away. Not something I could really feel right away. If they do start talking about cutting taxes, well, that's something I can go along with. They talk about the economy and putting people back to work. Well, maybe not me, but somebody else that I know, or a lot of people out there that don't have jobs or underpaying jobs. Well, that touches them. And again, that gets them to say, well, that's the candidate for me. So the economy is always something that's going to be a major part of any presidential campaign. We know that. Okay. So maybe that's something there that's going to actually help to renew some confidence and create some kind of an overall desire for people to buy into the markets and to bid up stocks, even though profitability is slowing, with the hope and thought that in the future, we're going to see that profitability will rise. Or maybe, well, you know what? The slowdown that we've seen recently, yes, due in part to the very high levels of the U.S. dollar, due in part by the slowdown in China, due in part by maybe the drop-off in commodity prices, or possibly in reverse, maybe commodity prices because of this. But nonetheless, all these things that come into play, perhaps these are just transitory. These are just temporary conditions that are going to pass us by very quickly, and we're going to return to normal, which I don't know if that means that oil gets backed up to 60, means that earnings grow at, let's say, 10%, because right now we're looking at about a 15% requirement to get us back to where we should be in terms of growth of earnings and the levels that are anticipated by most analysts for the S&P 500 in total. I don't know how we're going to get there if we have been seeing a consistent slowdown. Is it possible that they're baking into the pie the thought that maybe the energy companies, material companies are going to do just so much better, but yet we know that they're still not looking at any of these companies, well, not any, but the totality of these companies showing a loss. They're still showing a profitability for the energy companies, which we know is not true. It would be really hard for these companies to snap back very, very quickly. Now, of course, we did see the one thing that they did do, very brilliant move by many of these energy companies, is they had secondary offerings. Talked about them last time in our last show, and I think even the discussion before that, and on DH Unplugged. Just a brilliant move to do so in order to provide them a little more breathing space, a little more money on the books so that they could pay down their debt or possibly even continue paying off the interest that's due on their debt and appease their shareholders and calm everybody down a little bit that bankruptcy is not imminent. While they did dilute their shares pretty significantly by doing that, many companies, and there's a lot more probably coming out because they see it worked so well that investors said, oh, that's a good thing. Cutting the dividend, they didn't like so much. Investors didn't like the cutting of the dividends. They didn't like the fact that we're showing major losses. They didn't like the fact that we are selling off our assets. They didn't like the fact that we're shuttering many rigs. We didn't like the fact that we're laying off employees. But they did like these secondary offerings because it brought a lot of money in very quickly. Even with the dilution, even with the fact that their earnings are going to be diluted over many more shares and cause a drop in their earnings and the EPS. So that's a good thing. That was a very smart move. It did, in fact, you know, they had to give up some of the company, they had to sell it back to the public, but it was a good move. And we saw that brilliantly play out in the share price of many of these companies. But still, when we look at the price of oil, where it is still about $40 or right at about those levels, that still is not the level that we need to see for these companies to maintain a very healthy level of profitability and thereby transferring that to their balance sheet and to the overall longevity of many of these energy-related companies, particularly those that are in some of the areas like North Dakota and some of the, we'll call them second tiers. The big boys are doing okay. They'll hold out. So energy has been an interesting play. The question is whether or not this is going to be something that we see continue to have a turnaround this year if, in fact, we see that oil stabilizes and maybe even rise a little bit from here. There is the possibility that we'll see the continuation of this rumor cycle about OPEC freezing or shutting down production. We saw that there was another reduction of about 14 rigs last week in the Baker Hughes rig count on a weekly basis. So we are seeing that that is occurring very much on schedule and on a trend that we've been seeing, that less and less rigs are active, less drilling going on, less production going, well, not less production, but less drilling going on. Production is still pretty high in the overall. And that's why we saw 11 million barrel build, which was essentially, you know, I don't want to say it was ignored, but, you know, oil did fall a bit last week, but still, there doesn't seem to be the panic that we saw when we saw those kind of builds in the past. Possibly there was the idea that, well, some of the builds are over. We did see that this week the build started to get massive again. Last couple of weeks, the builds weren't that bad. And we thought we were at a turning point on this whole inventory build cycle for oil. But no, 11 million barrel build. That's enormous. Just more and more oil going into the inventories, to the containers, to the ships that are floating around aimlessly, just holding on to oil, hoping that one day, I guess, prices come back and they can then distribute, or really not so much prices come back, but demand comes back to a point that this oil is being used. Because remember, it's not so much just the pricing issue right now, it's the fact that the oil is building because the production is higher than the demand. So anybody that wants to talk about this is a one-sided situation, that its whole production base can't really be right because the demand is not bringing down the usage of oil so that it can transfer through to the use by individuals and companies and whoever else uses the material in any form of manufacturing. And that's why we have these builds. So it's a two-part process. Its production is not matched to demand. And demand is not picking up, and that's why we have the inventory builds that are continuing. Does that make sense? It's very simple, right? Supply, demand, economics 101. So you have a mismatch on production and on demand, and you have the fighting going on that OPEC is saying, hey, we're really not going to cut back on inventory. We don't care how much inventories grow. We're not cutting back on production. And while we're seeing production slow down a little bit here in the U.S., it's really not so much that's moving the needle by any standard, and that's why we're having the global builds that we're seeing. But still, we did see that energy stocks have come back in a great way, where a lot of them were possibly going bankrupt, at least in the minds of investors. We saw a lot of them come back, but then, I think they took a second look at them in the last couple of weeks and realized, well, still not looking so good. Now, material companies, on the other hand, it's interesting to note that we did see that the continuation of the rise of copper and of gold, for example, really did a wonderful thing for a company like Freeport-McMoRan. Now, Freeport was, I don't know, how low was that? $3? $3.50? $4? Peaked out last week at about 11, then started to come back in to the $10 range. Not a big deal on the drop, from where it was. But still, question is going to be whether or not Freeport is going to be a turnaround situation, or this is going to be another quick dead cat bounce for a stock and the stocks in its sector that are in the mining and metals area, and particularly those that are related to copper. And because we've seen that the imports for China, for example, have dropped off like 25% over the last year. And we know that there's not a lot of manufacturing going on anywhere else around the world. Copper being one of the main components of much of the manufacturing that goes on, well, that's going to continue to see a slowdown there. So unless copper prices come back, just like oil did, same scenario with supply-demand, same scenario with the fact that there's a lot of a reduction of use of the material, and therefore the company just can't make money at these low prices. So unless copper prices and gold prices are going to continue higher, silver as well, we're going to see some of these companies and many of the countries that rely on this also as the bread and butter of what they do from an export standpoint continue to have problems. Now, emerging markets did pull up pretty nicely over the last several weeks. As a matter of fact, the turnaround in emerging markets in, called the latter part of February into March, pretty outstanding. And a lot of it is due to the fact of their reliance on natural resources and the fact that they did pick up and stabilize, and the realization that maybe things aren't that bad, or at least it overshot where it should have on the downside, and now it's been picked up. You can take a look at many of the names. You saw a lot of double bottoms. You saw a lot of basing technical levels that were seen, and miraculously just massive short covering and a pull-up for those. So I would continue watching the material space, the energy space, and the one that we have our eye on right now, and I think I mentioned this last week, and I definitely mentioned it on the DH Unplugged show, was biotechs. Now, biotech and healthcare have been under siege ever since we saw last year the concern over how biotechs and pharmaceuticals price their medicines, and how some companies come in, like a Valiant, Mallinckrodt, Endopharmaceuticals, and a few others come in, and they actually buy these drugs. And they just basically don't do any research or development at all, don't do anything more than become a marketing company for a drug, but at the same time, and probably more interestingly, just simply increase the price manyfold and then force it down the throats of the consumer and healthcare patients. And they go out and do all sorts of marketing to promote this and really not do anything to create any additional benefit as a quote-unquote biotech or pharmacy company, a pharmaceutical company. Now, what's interesting about this is that I would think that there is something to be said about how these companies went about their buying of other companies and then just taking their drugs in and hiking their prices ridiculously. Obviously, there's something wrong with that model. We did see the breakdown of Valiant and the continuation of the breakdown of Valiant and the concern with other companies that do similar types of activities, and the entire industry just get, just ripped over the last year. However, this is not necessarily related only to the entire industry. There are some bad players, some bad actors in this whole deal, which have in fact been flushed out. Now, there may be more that come out of this, And there may be some practices that are embedded into many of these companies that are, we'll say, not ethical, morally reprehensible, possibly. I mean, when you're going to prey on patients that have illnesses that are going to potentially end in death if they don't take this drug, and you go and take a drug and move it from $1,000 to $30,000 per month for the regiment to take it, well, that's quite a concerning factor. Shows a horrible sense of ethics, just morally reprehensible, and just overall disgusting. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Let's not get to a point that we think that every single company is problematic. Not every company is going to have the same situation. Yeah, I do think that this will be a platform during the campaign. Remember something, during presidential cycles where we have the campaigns running, there's all sorts of possibilities that we will see different sectors having either pain or glory because they will run on various platforms, come up with various discussions. That is what we saw with Hillary Clinton when she first put her finger out at the biotech and pharmaceutical and healthcare industry. So what are we going to do? Well, we could just ignore it entirely and say, well, this is dead and we're not going to go near it. Or we can take a look at some of the technical levels of this and see where it is at a point that could be an interesting, viable opportunity, because many of these companies still are doing very well within the sector. Take a look at IBB, which is the NASDAQ biotech, as an example. And you just see that double bottom that recently was there, a little bit of a bounce off of that. And that could be something that you may want to look at from both a short and a long position. But right now, it does look like historically where we saw that downtrend. We didn't really break the downtrend necessarily yet, but it is an interesting place to start looking at if, in fact, these companies are going to continue, generally speaking, to produce and engineer and do some research and development that is good and provides a new grouping of cures, if you will, of drugs, that there is an opportunity here. Now, many of these companies obviously are going to be in the crosshairs, but there's many of them that will not be as well, and many of them that run their businesses well and that are not associated with the Valiants and those kind of companies that have done these unscrupulous acts in the sector. So just keep an eye on those, something to keep a look at. Other than that, I want you to make sure to listen to DH Unplugged each and every week. We have the closest to the pin competition that's running, and I think that you'll really enjoy being involved in that, where you guess the price of a stock on a particular date, and you compete against a lot of different people. We have some great giveaways on that as well. Listen to DH Unplugged or go to dhunplugged.com to check out more information on that. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, that's Andrew Horowitz, and of course, information about what we talk about on the show. Show notes are on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We're going to end it there, kind of a compact holiday shortened discussion, and come back with some more exciting things, some great guests in the next weeks to come. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.